As I peer out from my cave deep in outer space, I can't help but notice two twinkling blue lights that are new. Someone has arrived or returned to the heavens, where they are always welcome, and you're welcome to join me in the cave as well. But make sure that you're nice, and if you have some thoughts about the world, the universe, life, what it might be, well, you're always welcome to share them. I'd like to read to you now a bit of correspondence from James in Australia, who is dealing with some health issues and had some thoughts on life and all the things mentioned. So I will read that now. Good day, David. Wow. Thanks for the shout out. I was in hospital when I heard it and it felt great. I wanted to tell people, but I realized nobody would have a clue who you are. Can't fault you for that. I'm listening to them backwards and trying to catch up. I don't have much access to Wi-Fi in here, so sorry it took so long to respond. A theme that you float around often since the blast-off days is what the real nature of the universe, like is it a simulation or a hologram or a multiverse? I think you are often grasping at the questions around teleological arguments, while a pure 100% materialist would insist that there can be no meaning to life. Because to have meaning, there must be an objective purpose, like a hammer is used for hitting nails. Because it was made for that, it has a purpose. So your dad can say, don't do that with the hammer. That's not what it's for, because he owns it. So how can life have meaning, right? But it seems incredibly hard for people to accept that. Like I am constantly hearing young people say they're spiritual, but not religious. 90% of people feel something beyond what our intellect tells us. Obviously in here, with friends dying so often, we have the luxury of having conversations that get deep very quickly. It's not hard to share more with a friend in here. In 5 weeks before she dies, than a mate I've had since school. So I hear the same grasping from so many people. Even if they had a sincere religion before this, they quickly rocket past the superficial ritual to the mystical questions. I don't know how much you've read of the different religious texts, or if you grew up in a religion, I can't remember what you said. But I have tried to deeply look into Buddhism and Christian theology. As best as I can make out, I think that through history there have been people who have received profound insights into the nature of reality. These insights have transformed them. But they were limited to expressing this transformation in the language and culture of the time. So the Buddha looked at the Hindu tradition around him and saw that there could be more. So all his teaching is expressed in conversation with Hindu philosophy. He says, no single creator, no God, no soul that we must hold on to. He is grasping at the truth, but you can only use limited reflections. Jesus says, well, Moses has said an eye for an eye, but I say turn the other cheek. This is the pattern he mostly uses. He doesn't just say, oh, E equals MC squared. So the people around get stuck holding on to those words of wisdom. So it becomes their mission to hold on to these words and not let that change. And thus they become the institution that their founder tried to critique. Okay, so I know this all sounds like very basic undergraduate stuff, but I sometimes sit here and think, what if these physicists who question why the fabric of reality is written in perfect mathematical language, they toss around the idea we are all in, a simulation, because ultimately what is anything made of? Just buzzing energy all the way down? Never anything solid? Even mass is just a property of Higgs field, so why not? If so, it would seem to me to make sense to just reveal small parts at a time. In the beginner level of a tribe, there is no need to simulate a whole universe that takes up too much unnecessary data. So as human consciousness expands, so does the simulation. Expanding a step ahead, now the simulator is busy rendering all the details needed for exoplanets. Of course, this forces the question of what's the real world, or of what the real world is like, the creators of the simulation. Well, looking at our own growth and advanced civilization beyond ours by heaven,
1,000 years, a mere second, they would have quantum computers that could run powerful calculations needed and would be post-biological. Maybe they only exist now as uploaded avatars and observers? As speculative as this all sounds, nothing is radical to science, but it offers not a bit of help to someone dying, and it still doesn't address the question of teleology. Well, as far as I have progressed in that the hope to finding truth will come when the same systematic approach of science is used to examine the nature of love. I know this sounds like a collection of half-read pre-grad philosophy, but I'm not trying to butt toward a thesis here, just letting you know where I'm at. Anyway, I go home this weekend. Well, later today, Australian time. Peace, and thanks for your wonderful podcast. Well, James, I think that gives everyone a lot to think about, and I apologize if I stumbled through it a little bit. Some of the, it's just me. I'm bad at reading. But thanks to James, and I think I have posited that before, or something to the, and I do talk about it a lot, and I apologize if you're someone who is set in, we're just these bits of material, we're just biological, and that residue from that has resulted in a consciousness, and we're really have to accept that our lives are meaningless. And fine, if that's what you believe, but why not at least entertain the notion of other things, just for the sake of it, just to talk about it. And I like that James has kind of thrown that out there. So I figured for year two, rather than me just calling you and we'll just chat about whatever, which we can still do, but if that is a thought or what he wrote is something that stays with you and you want to talk about it and you have a thought, please don't write to me. I don't want to just be reading all of these things all the time, this correspondence. I'm happy to put you in touch with one another if you'd like, but if you'd like to talk about it, I think it's a worthwhile discussion to be had. And like he said, it perhaps is one that we won't get to, maybe not before someone who's really hoping for that answer that comes to a conclusion of their existence. Maybe we'll find it, and then we can race to places where people are, you know, dying and say, hey, we figured it out. We got it. Seems unlikely, but who knows? I like that idea, though. And if you have thoughts, again, let's share them. Let's chat about them. And thanks for saying it's a wonderful podcast. I appreciate that, James. I hope you guys are enjoying the show. I like doing it. I like chatting with all of you. I like chatting with these smart people and knowledgeable people. And let's get now to the bulk of this episode, which is a chat with someone who has been nothing but nice to me every time I've been in Portland, always reaching out saying, hey man, can I help you with anything? Can I tell you some good types of beer that there are? Can I drive you around? He's just been the nicest, most helpful person. And I think we talk about that a little bit in this episode. We'll talk about the beer that we drink. We're sitting in an open backyard in Portland, Oregon. You'll hear the ambiance, you'll hear the sounds, and I think it adds something to it. It just felt nice to be outside, looking at nature a little bit, having some beers. This is a farmer, me chatting with a farmer about all the questions that I have about the nature of big agriculture and small agriculture and farm-to-table things and a lot of those topics that are heavily discussed nowadays and maybe at the same time not discussed enough about where we're getting our food from. So here is part one, me sitting down with Chris Konieczka. We're not on a patio. We're in a standalone, it's not an enclosure. It's almost like a carport.
yeah.
With a ceiling fan.
You can't get a car in here from the front. We call it the palapa.
Palapa.
Because it's like in the shade, but it's definitely not going to stick around forever.
It's leaning a little bit. Yeah, there's a lot of things here I feel like I should take pictures of because we're in Portland. I was here for the Bridgetown Festival to give a backstory as to how Chris Konieczka and I became familiar. I guess your first reach out was either potentially the Kickstarter or it was when I did the Curious show and you helped like sell posters and things after, which was real helpful.
It's actually before that. The first one was I reached out the summer before that, also at Curious, and you were looking for someone to help record the show, and I got my roommate Barry.
Yeah, that's
to come
right.
Do it. And then what happened? Like you had the levels fucked up, I think, on the Zoom, and just nothing recorded, or it's just like way too loud.
He set out all those audience mics. Yeah, here we'll talk about this beer too. So this is Occidental Hefeweizen.
Yeah.
And you were kind of making fun of me that when I talk about the beers, and I've had plenty of beers. I've had enough beers by this point that I should know the difference. I've been to tastings at breweries many times, and I still don't really feel like I know beer all that well. And then you thought that's ridiculous, which I do too, but I think like my justification is that I can't tell the difference all the time between maltiness and hoppiness, and therefore, like, if I get a Pilsner, I'll be like, okay, this is a Pilsner, but then it's close to me to ale also, so like, is this an ale? Like, stout I can look at, but I might confuse it with a porter, just looking at it, and tasting probably the same.
Yeah, basically, you don't have much of a clue.
But
so I think that's fine. Like, you don't have to know about beer, you know? You can just enjoy drinking it and know what you think tastes good without being
I'm sure there's some quality to that that's genuine or something, you know, where like I'm all, kind of with these conversations, I don't retain a ton of it. So I'm kind of always starting at this level zero or like this, you know, this right. marker place.
So that's why I was hoping we'd try the beers. You'd tell, you know, you'd say what you think and then I'd be like, oh, well, that's this.
Okay. Well, I'll let you know, like, on my list of beers, Hefeweizen is usually kind of low on the end, except when I drink them, I like them, but I don't go out of my way to order them because I'm always afraid. I'm glad to have this one out of a can. Draft beers and the bars that you go to, you got to know the bar pretty well, because if they don't clean their beer lines, they can get those chemicals in there. Like, when someone comes through and puts the chemicals in, Hefeweizen is, this is usually so clear, it's hard to tell if some of that acid is in there. And so right. people, when they like, when you hear those terrifying stories of someone goes in a bar, drinks a big swig that's the first pull off of a keg, and it's full of that acid, you know, line cleaner, and then they burn out their stomach.
You should try the beer, see if it's that.
Okay. Well, I know it's from a can, so I trust it. So this is Occidental Brewing. This is a local one, you said.
Yeah, so these guys are up in St. John's in North Portland, and
oh, it's real good.
The tagline here is that, yeah, it's like everybody else's Hefeweizen, after you add the lemon or the orange, this already has that taste.
Oh, I see. It's in it. Because that's...
No, it's not in it. They just made a better beer.
Oh, I get it. I get it. Oh, so you're adding those citric sort of... Or, you know, citric acid elements to get this.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it. And it's like 90 degrees. We're in this backyard looking out at a chicken coop. Some beautiful flowers. Are those carnations?
Those are hydrangeas.
Whew. Pretty. And some trees. It's a very Portland, in like a rugged kind of way. I think everyone moves here and they drive a really expensive Audi and they go, what if in our backyard we grew something? This feels like, no, this is how it's meant to be lived. We grow stuff in the backyard. It's very alive. We've got this cool palapa. Did I say that right?
Palapa, yeah, that's
palapa.
It.
And now so to go back to our story, like you... Or do you want to talk about the beer more?
I want to say something about the beer.
Okay.
So the Hefeweizen is a wheat beer, right? Mm-hmm. It's got that very light taste.
Yeah, it's but crisp.
It's not so crisp like a Pilsner, though, right? It's not end.
Try it again. I feel like it's got this kind of, when you bring it to your nose, some little bubbles, it feels light.
Yeah.
Kind of like it's talking to you a little more than a beer would.
Right.
And then when it touches my lips, that's where, between this and Pilsner, like, I don't have a great palate to be like, I can't honestly, if I'm blindfolded tasting this, I don't know that I would definitely pick one or the other.
Oh, I don't think I would either.
Oh, okay. That's good to hear. So they're pretty close on the spectrum. And then
so
ale
both
is in
lagers,
the mix.
Right?
Lager.
So the
okay.
ale is the whole other category, right? Mm. The first division is ale or lager based on the type of yeast that you use.
Okay.
Right?
So you've brewed before.
In college. I haven't done it in a while, but yeah.
Okay, and you stay pretty familiar. You obviously stay familiar. This is... And this. What's embarrassing is that I've not only learned this at brewery tastings and such, but probably on this podcast as well.
Right.
And I don't retain it great. So, okay. Yeah. Ale and lager?
Yeah, just let's go for there. Just take that.
Okay,
ale and lager.
It.
That's a division. And then let's go back to... So Barry tried to help you record that show, but it didn't really work.
I screwed it up. And he said, do you want me to handle everything? And I go, yeah, sure. And then he had to go up this ladder to go up to the main mixing board. And he had the audience mics figured out. And I had been recording with the 4-channel on my Zoom. And so I was like, I got it. I'll just press record. I know how to do this part. The levels that I tested it at, this is how I figured it out afterward, I think. I set it up. The comedian before me was really loud. So they brought the board down, and then so I set the levels there. But then when I went on and I speak so much softer than that person, they push the levels way up, and so it ran the zoom, like, it just high-ended it out. Yeah, so everything sounded like I was just in a, yeah, like in an auditorium or something where you couldn't, it was like being at the back of a concert hall. It was so blown out. And so I got, and I really liked that set. I wanted to release that audio, and then listening to it, like I tried to fix it a couple of times, just couldn't. So I felt terrible because
it's too bad. Yeah, it's a good set. And hey, I wanted to mention that one of Barry's bands, Rosalit Bone, was performing at Tree Fort in March.
Oh, sweet.
And yeah, you guys,
we just missed each other.
Cross paths.
Yeah. Oh, they should send some music our way, play it on the show. That is the best music festival. I really liked it.
Yeah, this is the second year they played there. They had a great time, I think, both times around.
Yeah, I want to spread the word, but not too much, because I don't want someone selling me some sort of tech gadget and doing market research on me while I'm there. I like that it was just purely music and food. And arts, like there are people that, you know, I chopped this thing with an axe, and you can buy it from me. Like, wow, that seems very Idaho. Like, you carve this bear from a tree with an axe. I will buy that. So, Tree Fort Festival, quite good. And so anyway, that was the summer before.
Yep.
But was that was before the Kickstarter also. Yep. So then the Kickstarter, one of the packages, the one that you helped with, involved being a part of an Earwolf podcast, which meant you were going to be a guest on Blast Off, and then that ended, and then now this is out here in the Wild West, no network attached. So I apologize that the reward is not quite as sparkly.
Oh, no, I bought my way into 15 minutes, and this is, I'm living it.
You know, the weird thing about everyone who did that, the only person I haven't, one person never responded, never collected their reward. Everyone else I've recorded, other than my best friend, who for some reason is putting it off. He wanted to make it more about interviewing me or something like that, and we've yet to do it. But everyone has been pretty interesting. And I don't mean that in a, like, they had some interesting points. I mean, like, Juan, who I haven't heard from in a while, but Juan, how are you? Getting his PhD, and really fascinating, like talking about technology and marketing it. I thought that was really, really interesting. And then you, I guess the limited time we sort of spin around each other, not only with like the beer knowledge, you're always growing something. You've got raspberries that you picked from the backyard here, but you've been around farming as both like a laborer, kind of a hand, but you also seem to know or have like a really cutting edge sort of education on farming tactics and soil levels and things like that. And I might be overstepping there, but that, in my estimation, that's how I associate you.
Yeah, I don't know about cutting edge, but
but I mean, you're in
maybe
school
the cutting
right now,
edge
right?
There for small farms is just not that sharp. No, I'm actually a teacher.
Oh, okay.
I am the organic farming instructor at Clackamas Community College, and yeah, so it's a 1-year certificate program, and so yeah, now I try to teach the things that I learned to other people and help them have like a small successful business.
Cool, because you last time we hung out, you were saying someone was having some trouble, and I don't even remember, like they were looking at roots or stems or something like that, and meant to sort of just by looking at them tell what species or strain of a plant or something to that degree. Where I was like, that's interesting. I might be terribly misremembering that, but it was something to that effect, where I was like, oh, that's a good thing to know. Like, you could look out over a field and know not only the plant name, but kind of its history or its lineage, those sorts of things.
I'm not sure I remember that.
Well, I definitely remember. Maybe it had to do with marijuana.
That would be my guess, yeah, as you were describing the different strains and looking in the stems, yeah. I don't know that you can guess the strain from the stems or anything, but, you know, people try to be able to pick up, I guess, from the leaf, whether it's indica or sativa or something like that.
Okay. But, so have you grown pot before?
Yeah.
And is it just to make money, or do you enjoy, like, the farming process?
No, I've never made money off of it.
Just for yourself?
Yeah, both for me and friends, and just, like, yeah, the interest in doing it. And now that, you know, here in Oregon, it's legal, it's, like, less interesting than it used to be.
Sure, yeah. And then, okay, so your history then, because you say you worked on a bunch of farms, you kind of lived all over, you're from Wisconsin. What brought you out here? And then where, because I feel like now I've made myself seem like I have no knowledge of your history, but, you know, with teaching farming and, like, what did you have to know to get in that position? So essentially just explain your whole life to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was born a poor black child.
I knew it.
What I had to know? Well, gosh, I mean, there's... Well, first of all, there's, like, what I think I should know to share with students, and then there's what, you know, institutional processes say that someone who has this job needs to know.
Uh-huh.
And for that job, it was have to have a bachelor's degree, you know, need this many years experience in the industry, in this case, agriculture, mm-hmm. and then experience teaching. And so that's asking a lot, mm-hmm. right? That's like a number of things, and it's mostly going to be old people probably that have that. And
I've been farming for 50 years.
Yeah. And I was a teacher before that. And
yeah. What'd you teach then?
Huh?
Wait, you're saying the old person would say that?
Yeah.
Oh, got it. Okay.
No, I'm just filling in, you know,
yeah, yeah.
The old guy's friend. And I was lucky to be in that position. You know, I wasn't like a high school teacher before, but I was an extension agent. I did a lot of small group classes for farmers around Illinois. And there I was just telling you on the ride over for your big Peoria show. You
can yeah. Yeah, going to Peoria. Oh, that might have already happened by this point. I don't know when this comes out. But your view on farming to me, I guess that's what we've talked about a little bit. And, you know, it's with Monsanto and kind of the climate right now with everyone freaking out about things. And there's this pull toward getting back to being a little bit more self-sufficient for people or aspire to that. I think that's why part of the reason a lot of people move to a place like Portland is
totally.
Like, I want to get to where I know what's coming out of and what's going into my body. You know, like your leanings on that or your associations with that, like, you know, just politically and philosophically seem to not all, they don't always line up with how I think they would, I guess, to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think it's like most things that the more you know about it, the more complex making any decisions becomes,
mm-hmm.
you know, everything becomes more gray. But yeah, like I think in some of those things, like just with regards to Monsanto, you know, I don't think GMOs per se are the problem or particularly dangerous mm-hmm. in my own opinion.
Sure.
You know,
what about like the owning the, you know, the copyright to the genetics.
Oh, yeah, that's where I'm going. The problem that I see with that whole debate, and that doesn't get, you know, it's not part of the discussion about it,
uh-huh.
is that it's a completely unjust scenario where control of something foundational for society, food supply, right,
yeah.
is in a small number of hands that stand to profit off of it.
Yeah. Right?
That's really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that they have control of that.
Right.
For the billions of people that are trying to just get by in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the issue with it. Not that we're going to, like, turn into half-plant, you know, yeah. humanoids.
Yeah, that fear, I guess I understand it. Like, they're genetically modified, but they're still just, they're fish that can swim. They are plants that still go through photosynthesis. They're not weird things that you would recognize immediately. Like, look at that mutated weird thing. They look exactly like what they are. They're just sort of augmented genetically, right?
Well, in a basic sense, it means that they've had at least a gene from a different species,
mm-hmm.
right? Another organism put into them.
Yeah. So it's not that different than like a labradoodle or specifically breeding that.
Well, that's both dog DNA, right? Same species.
Oh, so these are different species?
Right. So this would be like a pig gene in a fish or a bacterial gene in a plant. That's
really?
Often what it is. Yeah.
Whoa, I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting. What would be the design of doing that? Why in the hell would you want to put a pig gene in a fish? Richer, fattier meat or something?
Well, in each case, it's designed for a specific purpose, but it's not always the same, right? Like mm-hmm. in the purpose of BT, for example.
What's BT?
Right. It's a pest control agent. It's putting a bacteria into a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that's in a lot of corn, right? And it allows the corn to create its own insecticide, which is bacteria of this certain shape. And when caterpillars eat it, you know, it's kind of got lots of sharp edges on a micro scale.
Uh-huh.
And it cuts up the caterpillar gut, right, and kills them.
Is that the one where they end up looking all like petrified?
I don't think it's any damage that externally you would know, like, that been, you know.
I saw some sort of a clip online or something one time where they had done that. A bacteria on a plant was, the caterpillars crawling on it would get, like, mummified as they touched it, which I thought was,
some extreme ones like that, or, like, those fungi that, like, burst out of the head of ants.
Yeah. So creepy. I think about this all the time when I'm driving through open fields and farmland and the heartland, that there are no birds. Like, that's free food to birds, and they just fly over and, like, no thanks. We don't need scarecrows. Like, they're smelling or sensing something that is, like, is their sense of, this is bad for us, it's put in there chemically by us, or is it that they have an awareness, like, that's what's leading to all of your newfound ailments and abnormalities, humans. Like, you're eating this poison, you don't even know it.
I suspect that it's not on that conscious of a level.
No, but it's, yeah, but it's maybe like instinctual.
Maybe. I mean, it's certainly possible that on a sensory level, they've got some trigger that's like, don't eat that.
Yeah.
You know? But I feel like in many cases, they probably are eating it and it's just not that harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case it's where it's particularly harmful, then those things are going under some selection pressure, right, for a big problem.
Oh, I see.
Which means that, just like other situations, ones that can survive that are going to breed and change the genetic makeup of the species.
And have you worked much in the big fields like that where, because Monsanto, that's the idea of that is for there never to be any selection, to sort of stave off evolution. We're like, we're going to keep making this gene over and over and over, and we're going to use whatever pesticides necessary to keep propagating this gene.
Yeah, it's like proprietary selection. Selection, right? Genetics can change when they want them to change.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, are you someone that feels like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park? Like, nature finds a way! Like, the soybean's gonna figure it out!
I never once have thought that I felt like Jeff Goldblum.
Till just now.
But, no, I don't think I have the nature finds a way attitude. It gets, I don't know, it's convoluted because, right, humans in some way are or were part of nature, and, you know, now we're in the whole mess.
Yeah.
So we're already affecting it, which means it's changing, you know, because of us. But
do you have like a Unabomber Ted Kaczynski manifesto outlook on it?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe, you know, because people say that makes sense. It's very rational and well thought out that we would distance ourselves from nature, and that would be a fundamental flaw. And the, you know, obviously people that are in the AI side of things are like, oh, that's ridiculous. Like, the Industrial Revolution was bound to happen. This tech revolution, bound to happen. It's just part of the evolution of the planet. Like, we're just moving past it. But lost in the shuffle there, when people bring up our ability to terraform a new planet or design a consciousness of a human that's in a robot or all these sorts of things, lost in there is like, but how do you feed them? And where does the food come from? Who grows it? And what are your thoughts on that? I mean, you're going to just be out in the field as all of this evolves around you. I come through next year and I'm wearing a space suit and I'm a hologram. Hey, man, I'm in New York right now. I just thought I'd stop by and say hi. And you're still riding a bicycle, doing things that are very, like, practical and human. And you haven't really bought into the quote-unquote, new evolution of humanity. Is that something that scares you? Is that idiotic?
Is it scares me to be on the more, like, advanced end of that?
No, to be on the other end, that, like, it would move past. You're content to just stay and, like, I know where, like, there's something, we talked about it on the ride over here, of you can get lost in all these big thoughts of reality and parallel universes and all this, but what's right in front of you, if you just enjoy that for your life,
you should have to enjoy it, right? Sometimes it's not going to be enjoyable, but if you can be at it with, like, the frustration or the stress or the good times too,
yeah,
you know, that's what, like, whether I'm a total Luddite on a bike somewhere, right, in my little farm field and all the UFOs are flying around, all of us things in there still have to be in our lives, you know. And if I'm good with that scenario, then fine, right? And if those aliens are good with their scenario, then
yeah,
right.
And there's no
sense.
They just
don't, like, you know, kill me for no reason.
Sure. And if they did, you'd go, hey, I'm just a guy picking raspberries, drinking beer, minding my chickens.
Yeah, like,
this is my life.
There's really nothing, you know, I could do. It would suck. But
sure.
At that point,
yeah,
I kill my aliens.
which is kind of a cool story. And maybe that's why they do draw their crop circles in farm fields and such. Cause like, this guy won't mind. He's just busy farming.
Speaking of farming.
Yeah, yeah.
This next beer.
The Commons Brewery.
It's from the Commons. It's right by Bossa Nova, where you played last night.
Yeah.
And this is the Urban Farmhouse Ale.
Whew. That is... Let me try to describe that with my limited palate. It's a little more tart, perhaps. There's not that effervescent kind of bubbliness to it. It's not wine-ish, but there's something... Yeah, like that bitterness a little bit in there. Mm-hmm. So it's not. It's kind of close to maybe almost like a sour, right?
In a way, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Commons does that with a bunch of fruit. They throw on different things, but I think that's right.
Okay.
Farmhouse, so, right? It's supposed to be simple, mm-hmm. right? Few ingredients.
Yeah, it doesn't... This like is not a beer that... Yours had a bit of a head on it when you poured it, but this doesn't taste like a beer that would have a head. It feels flat, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's real light for an ale.
Hmm, okay. The Commons Brewery. We're doing like a sampler where we just got several different types of beer. I'd have to say I preferred, and maybe I didn't, I did kind of cleanse my palate a little bit. I had, what's this fruit we're eating?
Kohlrabi.
Kohlrabi. With sea salt on it. You grew it here?
Grew it at school on the student farm.
Yeah, I want to get back to that a little bit. Like, what you grew up on a farm in Wisconsin?
No, I grew up in a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay, and you were drawn to kind of the agriculture lifestyle, digging. Were you playing the dirt a lot as a kid?
Yeah, that more than agriculture, just being outside, and you know, we had like kind of a parkway area in the town that was like a river and some woods, and just mm-hmm. goofing off and stuff in there, but not trying to grow food. I had to live in New York City first and then be like, how do people get the things they need to live? To be like, oh.
And then you...
Step back.
To go... So, before going to New York, you're just kind of a suburb kid. Did you go to college?
Yeah, I tried to go to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
Went there for 1 year. Then...
What were you going to study?
English. I was going to be a high school English teacher.
Okay.
And I kind of freaked out on big city.
Mm-hmm.
And... They changed my financial aid package significantly so that it's going to be a lot more debt to go there.
Oh, okay.
So I transferred back to the University of Wisconsin mm-hmm. and joined their agriculture program.
Weird. So big city English, not really working out great.
Small town. The classes and stuff were great. Mm-hmm. Excellent. My faculty, you know, college experience there, but I think just being a 19-year-old human in the world and trying to understand what's going on there when you're not from it is crazy.
That's a big change. And people do it, and they become New Yorkers, and they live the rest of their life there. But
oh, yeah.
And that's weird to think that in a parallel kind of reality that the financial aid package doesn't change, you could potentially be there doing that right now.
For sure.
Taking the subway, reading books, writing books.
Yeah, and then that would be my life. And when mm-hmm. the aliens come, I'd have to, you know, reckon with that.
Mm-hmm.
But
your sensibilities...
I'm glad it went this way.
And I think that lines up more, in my experience, with farmers. Because people like to think of them as simple, but I think that's silly. I think that they are smart enough to take simple pleasures in what it means to like be satisfied as a human. Like, that whole kind of Buddhist, like, chop wood, carry water thing. I think farmers figure it out. Like, I'm happy doing this. This provides something. Makes me feel good about... Whatever that is, the completion of it, the ability to help others, to share, I'm good with that. Is that kind of how you line up philosophically?
Well, that's part of it. You know, another part of it is that when you make that decision, like that's what you're going to do for income, is there's a bunch of stuff you have to do if you're going to survive it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're really going to make a business out of it. And so it's nice as a human to have that ability to be like, I find satisfaction in this thing that I do all the time.
Uh-huh.
And with farming, it's like it really concentrates and sort of limits the things that come into your life. Because you interact with the outside in like a farmer's market or some kind of marketing situation. And mm-hmm. then you're back on the farm with limited people that you run into on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And so it really sort of clarifies, like, you've got a lot of time to be with yourself and have, you know, go through how you're thinking and feeling about things.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah, this is great. And some days it's not.
But. Well, and that, to me, doesn't entirely line up with, you know, the aliens are going to come. I'm just doing my thing. I'm living. Because for me, like, a lot of time alone on a horse, my mind couldn't help but, and I guess that's different because my hands aren't really busy. I'm just essentially floating along on the back of this animal, just mindlessly almost. So my mind would wander off and like give me a lot of time to think about other things. And I would think as a farmer, when you're there picking and moving down the line and then picking something and moving down the line or digging or whatever you're doing, you're thinking about that a little, but it almost can be like a bit of meditation where your mind can wander from that.
Yeah, for sure. Where, yeah, sort of underneath thought where, yeah, you're coming from a place of you've done this enough times that
yeah.
either you can just be wholly in that thing, like, you know, I'm harvesting carrots.
Yeah.
Or you can be like, all right, I'm weeding. This is a low stakes situation. I can let my mind run off to, mm-hmm. hey, oh, so it's inevitable, right, that there's aliens somewhere because there's infinite, you know, universes. And so you can go there too. It depends on the activity.
I see.
And if it's a group activity, it's always great to talk to other people because you've been in that you know, spot in your head for a while. And so then you can just laugh at things like, you know, carrots that have a penis and just... Mm-hmm.
the simple joys too. Of yeah. farming. And so when you sell, do you make a business? I mean, you have the school. Do you sell produce and things from that?
From the school farm, yeah. We have a weekly farmer's market on campus, although we're the only vendor, so it's really more of a farm market.
Yeah, and real monopoly you guys got out
there.
Yeah,
everything I just said about Monsanto is bullshit. and we sell to a restaurant in the city. It's an Italian restaurant, and they buy like romaine lettuce, basil, beets, eggplant, a few other things from us, mm-hmm. parsley. And it's like they're getting organic produce at a cheap rate, and we're getting an experience where students can like invoice a business, mm-hmm. you know, and pack orders for a restaurant and go in and see what it looks like to deliver to them and stuff.
And you get to be on that small end of it where what happens when demand starts just slightly outpacing what you produce and there is an impulse to, you know, add some steroids or boost it up just a shade, you know, just to meet ends, you know, just say, hey, we this order means a lot of money. Bigger and bigger and bigger as everyone goes and gets, or obviously as a school farm, you're allowed to kind of go, sorry guys, we don't have it. But do you see that being across the board a problem that farmers have, or do farmers say like, well, this is it, this is all we have, you got to go to a different place to get the rest of it?
Yeah, it really depends on what your market outlets are. Like if you're selling exclusively to restaurants, for example, mm-hmm. you tell them every week, you know, here's what we have available.
Yeah.
You choose.
Right? So that whole farm-to-table popular thing right now, a restaurant that could really capitalize on that would say, hey, the beets came in this week, so we got a lot of beet-related dishes, but then there aren't going to be beets next week. Is that... But you have to have a similar menu because you want word to get out, so you want to serve the same dish for months at a time.
Yeah, and if you have a relationship with the restaurant where you can talk about it ahead of time, that's better. Anytime mm-hmm. you can sell something before you've grown it,
yeah.
right, then the risk of losing money on it is less.
But does the anxiety go up of like, what if bugs come in or if there's a fire or blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, maybe, but like that shit's always going to happen. That's what part of the job is to try yeah. to deal with it.
And you don't need to be like insured. Is it still kind of like a handshake relationship, farmers and vendors? Or is it, hey, you jerks, we bought all this stuff or we agreed to and now it got burned up. We don't care. Where's our stuff?
Yeah, it depends on what scale you're selling at. If you're doing CSA, farmer's market, something very small scale, maybe selling to like a co-op or a local grocery store. Most can be a handshake agreement. Sometimes you're required to have liability insurance to sell at a farmer's market or something like that. But if you're trying to sell to a wholesale distributor that's selling out to larger grocery stores, you know, putting it on the shelf at some chain place, then you need to have a specific quantity met all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, you want to deliver it in full on time every time. But if you're small, I mean, one of the farms that I managed, right, sometimes shit happens and sometimes it's 100 degrees for 3 days and the spinach doesn't turn out right and you have to call the restaurants and say, hey, spinach bolted, doesn't taste good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sorry, wait till next week.
Yeah. So you've managed farms, worked on farms, kind of built up a knowledge. You could go... in theory, anywhere in the world, but especially in the United States, could you go work on a giant corn farm in the Midwest that has combines and just this giant sort of production? Or do you feel more comfortable like going out to pick carrots with your crew and, you know, using a hoe or how much tractor work is involved in your type of farms?
Yeah, I definitely feel more comfortable on the smaller end of it. We have a 33 horsepower tractor, and so that's pretty small.
Yeah,
I think most small farms have something like a 40 horse, maybe 38 horsepower tractor, small one that you can do some tillage with. When you get up into the next stage of maybe you're over 10 acres or something like that, it can really benefit to do some weeding with the tractor. And so, yeah, I'm comfortable in either of those stages. I could probably get a job on like a commercial production farm, but most of the jobs there are, you're really more of a like equipment operator.
Yeah,
you know, you're just like driving combine 12 hours a day in one season, and the other season you're driving the sprayer and doing whatever other things need to be done.
Well, give me an idea then of a small farm day to day, because I think you think of just as the on the most basic level, when you think of a farm, you think it's kind of growing, it's kind of doing its own thing. Do you go prune stuff or weed it? Or when you're there and you show up at like the big shop or the main barn, do you have a dry erase board and you have to kind of dictate to people, we're going to put some B40 fertilizer on this field, and then let's turn this one over and let's let this one dry out and let's rototill this one, and now it's time to harvest these things, let's give them a couple days. I mean, are you, is that it, day-to-day, kind of that level? Give me an idea of, like, how you would organize
those sorts of things. For some day, that could be pretty accurate, you know, and it changes with the season, of course, but on, like, a diversified farm where, you know, you have a variety of things at the farmer's market to sell, or a CSA box of diverse crops.
What's CSA?
Oh, Community Supported Agriculture. It's the concept of, like, pre-subscription at the beginning of a season to give the farmer initial capital for the year, and then in exchange you get a weekly box of produce based on what was harvested that week. You know, and so you try to get a diversity of things. Usually it could be like, you know, 6 to 10 things depending on the size and the farm.
And how many boxes, say on a small farm, would you be packing daily?
It varies. You know, some of the farms I've worked on have had CSAs with, that would be 50 boxes in a day, 100 boxes in a day. Yeah.
That's got to get kind of tiring.
And so the days are really determined by what your market outlets are, to answer your question. So it's like, okay, we have a markets on Tuesday and Saturday. So harvest days are Monday and Friday, right? So those days we bust our ass to get everything picked, washed, packed into the cooler so we can go sell them the next day. You know, then...
And what type of crew, just sorry to interrupt, but like when you say that, when you gather around team, we're harvesting this whole field. Is it 1 acre, 2 acres, 10 people? Is there a body per acre kind of relationship there?
Yeah, it's some... The general thumb rule, I guess, people say is one person per acre, but it's completely variable on the diversity of crops that you have, how mechanized you are, you know.
And how do you like to be with that? Real mechanized, or do you prefer it like put on this satchel and get out there and pick those carrots?
Oh, personally, I prefer the lowest possible level of mechanization. I think for a, you know, a production level small farm, I think it makes sense to have a tractor, but if I was gonna have my own farm at this point, it would be like a 1 or 2 acre thing I could do with just a walk behind tractor and try to keep it real simple.
Yeah,
because I'm not like a mechanic.
Okay, and I just had a sip of our third beer, which is the Freem. Is that how you say it?
This one's from Hood River.
I had the Citrus IPA yesterday from Freem. Really enjoyed it. I like, I'd never heard of it. I've been here, obviously, a bunch of times to Portland, never heard of Freem. And this, to me, I think, is either a lager or... So it's lager or ale? Why do those things taste so similar to me?
This one is a bit tricky in that way. So lagers oftentimes are the ones with the maltier taste, which is like sweeter, right? This is a little bit of what you're getting here.
Okay.
But this is a Belgian ale, so it's like...
Ah, damn it, it says it right there. Yeah. I was looking at the main label, trying to get a clue. It doesn't say anything, but then right above it, so it's a blonde
ale. How little this guy knows about beer. Can't even read the label.
Damn it. Blonde ale. Okay, yeah, it fits like the warm weather. That's what I typically like to... I order it knowing that I'm going to get something like this, and yet tasting it blindly, I wouldn't be like... That's a blonde ale.
Oh, I think that's the reality for me, too. And I feel like I know something about beer. But I think that most of that is like hardly anybody could really do that.
Oh, okay.
There's so many different things now, and there's so many like nuances of style that
Doesn't
really matter that much.
This is great, though. This is like when I think of beer, I think for most people, blonde ale is kind of lighter. It is for like a warm day like this. Like it's not, you know, it's not hoppy. It's not going to like punch you in the face, but it's got a full body to it. It's got a lot of nice taste.
Yeah, but it won't weigh you down. You can, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We can drink this all day.
Yeah.
And we shall. So that involved with farming. Like you were just saying, like, you know, you taste the beer, kind of a brewer has to get a little sample. Do you pick something, you know, a carrot, kind of wash it off against your pant leg and take a bite?
Definitely, wherever possible. You know, some things are mostly cooked. You probably don't bite into the beet to make sure that it's ripe, you know.
Right.
You try to look at other factors and then relate that to your experience of like, oh, that night when you made those beets for dinner, oh, there was this kind of rotten inside. You should have picked those last week, you know. But for the most part, yeah, you want to try it. Plus it's
and do you have like a big long cool farm table where you bring everyone in there at the farm? Can you serve meals there? Is there a farmhouse
at the school?
Yeah.
No, I wish. This would be great.
Yeah.
So yeah, any large-scale donors out there for organic farming programs, find me.
That seems like an ideal scenario to have, where whether you have to, like, I think of neighborhood farms, and this oddly is kind of interesting to me to hear that of course a farm has to work and churn stuff out weekly or regularly. In my mind, it's like there's a harvest at this period, then we get everything out of there, and then we sort of store it. But it's not. It's sloughing things off and churning things out pretty regularly over the course of the growing season for that particular thing.
Yeah, for a small diversified farm. I mean, for a large commodity farm, it is what you first described. Like the corn or the soybeans, you grow them, you harvest them in the fall.
Yeah.
And then prices go down on the commodities market because everyone just, you know.
Yeah. So you guys, I like this style more, but I feel like what they get to have, and depending on how big they are, but is that you come in and you take your gloves off and kind of bang them against your leg to get, you know, the mud off, and you throw them down somewhere, and then you walk into this mud room in a big house, and there's a long table, and everyone sits down, and like you cook up the stuff that you just picked. You know, that seems like the ultimate communal aspect of farming that would be really enjoyable.
Yeah, if you find that enjoyable, then doing that, you know, farming will deeply satisfy you.
Yeah.
Like, to be in a position where you're at a place and you can think, all of these things are possible for me to cook today. Mm-hmm. You know, if you like cooking or want to eat, care about eating, it's great. And then, you know, if you incorporate livestock in too, you've got...
And do you guys do that?
At the school, yet we haven't. I hope that we get there, but I've been there 3 years. I'm supposed to be building up the program till we get a certain level of, you know, student enrollment on a regular basis, and then I think I've got a little more leeway to make some demands.
And do you feel like, is there an influx of people, like we kind of talked about moving here, saying, hey, I want to get back to the earth a little bit, and do you feel like you're providing a knowledge, sort of a key to a different time? Like, well, we real quickly bypassed where a whole generation grew up not knowing how to plant something, how to cultivate it, and now you're giving that back to them a little bit. Are you retaining ancient sort of handed down, very, not necessarily primitive, but, you know, earth techniques?
I feel way better about my job now.
That's what I like to do.
Yeah.
I want you to feel, because I feel that to a certain degree. I mean, people that, you know, get involved in, like, a few years ago, I was at this craft sort of fair in Minnesota, and they're kind of like fond of like the, you know, Viking culture and Norwegian sort of things. And one of them, this guy had this rope tied to a ceiling that was wrapped around a log that he would push with a pedal, so it would kind of like turn this thing back and forth. So it kind of worked like this really primitive lathe. And he was spinning this bowl around endlessly with his foot, pedaling it and cutting into this piece of wood to make this stupid bowl, where I was like, who cares? Like, that does not need to still be done. And yet I could kind of appreciate, all right, I get it. This is an ancient technique. Like, the people that first thought of this, brilliant. But we've moved on from that. Whereas farming hasn't changed a ton. Put seed in ground, water it, take care of it, harvest.
Yeah, that part of it probably hasn't changed that much. I think now what you need to tune people's ear to is that it's a business that, for better or for worse, we exist in modern, you know, American capitalism, and this is like a marginalized job option.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to be pretty savvy and think about where you really fit in. and run a solid business if you also want the cosmic connection with the past or whatever.
yeah. And so when we have talked in the past, just mildly, certainly not having like great political discussions or anything, but you seem to have an aversion toward both major parties, which means that you have this fundamental kind of understanding of things you dislike about both, and maybe the overall machine that is capitalism, that is the United States. Do you have to work within that? Do you align with something apolitical sort of ethos? And how do those things line up with being an effective farmer and to succeed at it? All that.
Yeah, I think that you, of course, have to try to work within it.
Mm-hmm.
And some days that feels slimy, you know, because that means, I'm sure it feels that way for you. You know, you're trying as a performer to like keep it pretty real. Don't put ads in Space Cave, you know,
yeah.
All these things, like engage other unknown animators in creating the special. Right, it's cool, but you also like need some marketing to have a career to keep doing that shit.
Sure, yeah.
And that's how it is you have to do some marketing,
yeah.
You know, to sell the stuff so that you can come home and pull everything out of the garden and make it and
yeah.
Sit there and, you know, play mandolin until you pass out or whatever.
But isn't that what everyone is kind of doing? Like, how can I exist within this machinery that I don't love, but I've got to figure out how to dance around it without it consuming me? Like,
no, before. I don't think everyone's doing that.
You think people are living freely, or you think they're buying in completely?
More the second one. But
yeah.
I also think some people are looking at it as a pretty raw sort of, you know, competition, and they're trying to do well at it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if they have to step on some toes, you know, or some other people have to lose so they can win, then that's what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but don't you feel like that is big business and to go to like Animal Farm, to bring it into farming, like the pigs. The pigs kind of understood that and were the most ruthless and kind of like, yes, everyone is equal, but some are more equal than others. I'm playing the game. I understand like you got to scheme and you got to duck and dive and shake the right hands and say the right things and work through this maze and be a scummy jerk as you do it. And it's weird to think that in farming, that the avenue to pursue that does kind of exist. And to me, it almost seems like it'd be foreign. Like, we just grow our stuff and we put it out. If you want to buy it, great. But you do have to, like, brand it properly, get a banner to put up at the farmer's market or something like that. Are those the little things you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, this is the case for all humans doing all things, right? Is there's going to be sleazy, you know, crooked farmers, and there's going to be, you know, people who are disingenuous in any position.
Yeah.
Right? And sometimes it matters more what your connections are, what your smile looks like,
mm-hmm.
you know, and who you can glad hand.
The type of pickup truck you drive.
Yeah. Than the quality of the produce or the quality of the comedy or whatever the thing is.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I want to really get into that, like your views on Monsanto, but beyond just Monsanto, but like all that, the capitalism of it and how you pursue it and what your view is on. But let's take a quick break. We've got our three delicious beers. I think the Hef, I'm going to shorten it. I don't love when people say Hef.
They're usually talking about, you know, Hugh Hefner.
They are. And that maybe that's the association I have. It's like Neanderthal. Don't like saying it that way. I like Neanderthal. Feels better off the tongue. There are a handful of other words that way. Alzheimer's. I just like saying Alzheimer's. That's probably acceptable. But Hefeweizen, same thing. I don't like saying it. However, I like that one. I like the Blonde Ale. They're probably neck and neck. The Farmhouse I didn't dislike. It's just a little outside of the realm of these two. When, you know, maybe the lightness or something like that.
For sure.
All right. So, now that I've rambled on about these beers, what's your favorite? Do you have one? Now that beer needs to have a competition.
Well, it's part of reality, too. I'd say out of these, my favorite is the Freem Belgian.
It's pretty good. And I've sort of lately kind of soured on Belgian stuff a little. I don't know why. The too malty sometimes. But this is not too malty. I really like it.
Yeah, it's just a hint of sweet in there.
Just like us. All right, let's take a quick break. And then we'll have more Chris Konieczka. And we'll be back with part two. That guy knows his farming. I think it's just fun to see those chickens and see someone who doesn't seem like a psychopath be like, yep, I'll be killing them soon. And a friend of mine used to do this bit where she would read A Day No Pigs Would Die from on stage. And, you know, the dad has to kill his pig at one point, and then the kid's just incensed. Then he finds out that the dad is pretty emotional about it. Like, this is not something that's easy for me, but this is our life cycle. And I know now a lot of people are vegans and able to look past and say, we don't need that anymore. We don't need to produce meat. Everyone, I hope you're getting the food that you like in an ethical manner that you like, and that you're happy and healthy. And if you're interested in knowing more about how to grow it, get in touch with Chris. I can put you in touch, or just listen to part two, and we'll chat more about farming, the soil, what's in it, where to get good food, how to maintain your crops, all that stuff. I think it's fascinating. I think it's worth knowing on this planet that we live on, just what's healthy to eat and how we get it. So anyway, more beer, more chats with Chris next week. Thanks to those of you who purchase posters and help support the show. If you'd like to donate, feel free to do that at thespacecave.com. If you want to actually get something in return, there's a limited edition poster up now. And then I made some other posters as well that I'll put up shortly. But they're only, by the time this goes out, I don't know for sure if there are some left. But if you'd like one of this astronaut looking into deep space and seeing a... Oh, I won't give it away. Go to the site and look up the poster or the Twitter. You can follow it at @space_cave. My Twitter is Huntsberger Junk. There's nothing that interesting there. Some people bought the posters because I posted them on Instagram, which is a thing I've had for a while, but I don't use all that often. But I kind of like it. So if you want to follow me on there, I'll be posting little drawings and things like that. And oddities that I find in the world. Whatever anyone does with Instagram. Even some sunsets from time to time. I find those delightful. Who doesn't like a good sunset? All right, let's get out of here. Those twinkly blue lights made us all sad, but for while they were here, they made us all so happy. And I used to always have this... I don't think I had this debate with anyone in person. It was always in my head of wondering who the coolest white person was. And there are not a lot of cool white people. And you can be like, oh, that guy was kind of cool. Dean Martin, eh. I don't know why that... David Bowie, maybe these people are associated with being cool. Not a lot of them, though. I don't know, for whatever reason, it's just not... I never find a lot of white folks all that cool. But Gene Wilder seemed like the coolest guy. Getting to hang out with Richard Pryor and be an equal. Hold court with Richard Pryor and be just as funny, that's pretty hard to do. And he made it look so easy. He was so funny and so great at being any signature role that you remember him in. One of the most subtle things that he was in that I remember, I think about it all the time, it still makes me crack up, is in Stir Crazy, which I know a lot of people don't think that's the greatest movie, and maybe it's not. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I know that as a rodeo person, there's this, you know, it's a prison rodeo, and Gene Wilder goes to get on this bronco, this bucking horse, and these guys are going, hey, be careful. This horse is pretty rank. It's pretty dangerous. And just as calm as if he were stepping into a bath, Gene Wilder just goes, oh, he's a sweetheart. And then hops on him. And then I remember watching that as a kid thinking like, wow, he's so mellow. He's just going to ride this horse. This is cool. And then the horse leaves and goes three jumps and he just instantly falls off. And, oh, I don't know why that always makes me laugh. Just the thought of it, just how casual he is about it. And I don't know. There was something to that. Maybe to me, he'll always embody Willy Wonka, and everything that Willy Wonka stood for. And I think the greatest thing, whether we are just these little bits of biological material that have this consciousness as an afterthought, and we're not anything more than that on this world, or if we're a big part of the universe and these atoms coursing through us will return out into the universe and continue to be a part of it. Regardless, I think while we are here in these human forms, the best thing that we are endowed with is our imagination. It can take you from a bad place to a good place, and a good place to a great place, or a place that doesn't even exist. It can really take your mind off of the world being however you see it, good or bad, and that is pretty wonderful. And this is Gene Wilder singing about the imagination. Thanks for visiting the Space Cave.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be In a world of pure imagination, take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
Hurry up, Violet!
This way, Grandpa!
There's no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be. Simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it. There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly